I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Disasters like wildfires and hurricanes can destroy electrical lines, leading to long blackouts. When the power's out, it's only a matter of time before the food in the fridge and freezer starts to go bad. So if you think you might lose electricity, stock up on foods that do not need to be refrigerated, like crackers, peanut butter, cereal, and apples. Move refrigerated foods into the freezer so they'll stay cold for a longer time without power. You can also store food in a cooler filled with ice. If you need to cook, you can use an outdoor grill when the weather is safe. Or if you have a gas stove, you may be able to manually light it with matches. During a blackout, keep the fridge and freezer doors closed as much as possible so the food stays cold. But if the power stays out for 4 hours or more, toss anything in the fridge that can go bad, like meat, milk, leftovers, or eggs. Do the same if a refrigerator thermometer shows that the temperature in the fridge has risen above 40 degrees. And if you're not sure if something is still safe to eat, throw it out. As climate change causes more extreme weather, power outages may become more likely, but preparing ahead of time can help get you through a blackout safely. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Now, at the time, of course, that coup seemed like a complete success. At relatively low cost, the United States had overthrown a government that it didn't like and brought back the Shah, who was obviously now prepared to do America's bidding. It was a perfect success, or so it seemed at the time. It is only now, from the perspective of 50 years, that we are able to look back and see the horrific long-term consequences that this apparent success actually produced for us.
That's Stephen Kinzer, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Kinzer on Iran, the 1953 American coup, and the end of democracy. Regime change started decades ago. The new term is just a change of clothes. Dwight Eisenhower was president when the United States overthrew the popular democratic government of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. What was Mossadegh's transgression? He wanted Iran's oil to benefit the Iranian people. The coup brought the Shah back from exile and put him on the peacock throne. What ensued was 25 years of tyranny and repression, culminating in Ayatollah Khomeini's Islamic Revolution. The coup in Iran was one of the pivotal events of the 20th century. Virtually all Iranians know about it, yet most Americans haven't even heard of it. The U.S. professes that it supports democracy in the Middle East, yet when there was a democratic government in Iran, the U.S. destroyed it. Here to tell the story of those events is Stephen Kinzer. He's a veteran New York Times correspondent. He's co-author of Bitter Fruit and author of Crescent and Star. His latest book, A Times Notable Book of the Year, is on the 1953 coup in Iran and is called All the Shah's Men. Stephen Kinzer spoke at the Pacifica Asia Museum in Pasadena, California, in mid-September 2003.
It was August 19th, 1953. The CIA overthrew a government for the first time. It's hard for us to imagine, knowing what we know about regime change and covert action in the CIA now, that there was a time when the CIA was not thought of as an organization that should be involved in overthrowing regimes. That it should have only been an intelligence agency supposed to provide information for the foreign policy organs of the United States. This coup set the United States off on the path of covert action and regime change. And every government that we have overthrown or tried to overthrow in the 50 years since then has been the victim of a process that began with the intervention of 1953 in Iran. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the background of this operation and then how it was carried out and what its effects have been, because there is no better lesson in the 20th century history of the United States, and I say this as one who has immersed myself in this history, that teaches us so clearly about the unintended long-term effects of our interventions abroad than this operation. I wrote this book with the idea that I was going to tell a story that on the one hand was profoundly important in shaping the history of the United States, the history of Iran, and really the history of the world, but an episode that has been largely forgotten. Really, most Americans and most people in the world, even those that are interested in international affairs, have only the vaguest idea that this thing ever happened, much less that it had such a profound effect on shaping the whole Cold War and post-Cold War world. But as I was writing it, I slowly took on what I thought was a complementary but somewhat different mission. I realized that I wasn't just telling the story of a particular episode that was very important but had been lost to history. But in addition to that, I was resurrecting the figure of a man who in the mid-20th century was one of the most famous, most debated, most controversial, most fascinating, most interesting people in the world, but who today is almost completely unknown. And that is Mohammad Mossadegh, the nationalist leader who was the victim of the 1953 coup. In the mid-century, Mossadegh shook the world and challenged the system that had dominated the world for centuries. And in 1951, in recognition of his huge impact on the world, Time magazine named Mohammad Mossadegh as its Man of the Year, which meant that in the first issue of Time magazine in January of 1952, Mossadegh appeared on the cover of Time magazine. Actually, he beat out for the honor of Man of the Year 1951 Douglas MacArthur, Winston Churchill, Dwight Eisenhower, and Harry Truman. And in those days, Time magazine was actually making good choices. Mossadegh was more important in that year than any of those great figures with whom we are today so familiar. Mohammad Mossadegh was truly a unique and original historical figure. By the time he came to power in 1951, Mossadegh was already elderly. He had had a political career in the 1920s and 30s, but when the dictatorship of Reza Shah emerged, he was excluded from parliament. He went back to his village. Most people assumed that his political life was over, and I believe he assumed that himself. He had no idea that he would ever come back. But decades later, really, Iran became a democracy. Reza Shah was overthrown. He was sent off to exile in South Africa. And Iran resumed its march toward democracy. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, the ideology of nationalism, of anti-colonialism, was surging through the developing world. All the countries of Asia, Latin America, and Africa were looking at the structures that dominated them in ways they had never examined these structures before. Now, bear in mind, this was a time when the voice of poor countries had really never been raised in the councils of the great powers. This was a period before Castro and Nkrumah and Nasser and Sukarno. Mossadegh was treading completely new territory. Nobody had ever done what he did. Mossadegh had two great principles. His entire political career was shaped by two ideas. The first idea was democracy. Mossadegh was a very sophisticated intellectual. He actually came from the royal family that had ruled Iran for several centuries up until the beginning of the 20th century. He was educated in France and Switzerland. He spoke fluent French, which was the language he used in his international travels. And when he emerged as a political figure in the late 1940s in Iran, he had the idea that he would try to bring Iran onto the path of democracy. In fact, as I will point out later on, his embrace of democracy was so profound and so deep and so sincere that it really bordered on the naive. He was so willing to tolerate opposition that he didn't even want to crack down when the CIA and other enemies in the pay of foreign forces were demonstrating and protesting and arranging his overthrow. So democracy was his first platform. His other great dream was to establish Iranian control over Iran. Now, from the perspective of today, this doesn't sound so radical. But looking at the history of Iran, this was as dramatic a change as that country could ever have contemplated. Iran had always been a country, or for centuries before Mossadegh came to power, that had been divided between Russian influence and British influence. After the Bolshevik Revolution, Lenin actually made a wonderful gesture to Iran. He canceled all the debts that Iran had accumulated to Russia during the Tsarist years. And Russia more or less withdrew its influence from Iran. Therefore, Britain was the principal colonial power there. And Britain exercised its power not just by manipulating politics, imposing prime ministers, deposing those that it didn't like, but Britain also had a much more important lever. The most powerful, richest, and largest British enterprise in the entire world was the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. This company, through the expedient of bribing Iranian negotiators in the early years of the 20th century, had achieved a fantastically lucrative monopoly on the extraction of Iranian oil. Winston Churchill, as the First Lord of the Admiralty in the early part of the 20th century, was the one who pushed this along with a number of other British leaders. Winston Churchill knew as World War I was breaking out that oil was going to determine who was going to win this war. That oil, not coal, was going to start powering warships. But Britain had no oil. And no country that Britain controlled, and no British colony produced any oil. When Churchill realized the scope of what was available in Iran, and saw the terms by which Britain was now going to be able to extract all that oil, use it for the British Navy, to raise the standard of living in Britain, and then to earn huge amounts of foreign exchange from the sale of oil all over the world. He described it in a wonderful phrase as a prize from fairyland beyond our wildest dreams. That was what Iranian oil was for Britain. And as I realized in researching this book, Britain would never have been able to play the role that it played in the world during the 1920s and 30s and 40s had it not been for the fantastic wealth that it sucked from under the deserts of Iran. Therefore, when Mossadegh arrived on the political scene with the platform of nationalism, which inevitably to every Iranian meant taking back our oil, he posed a profound challenge to what was then the governing world system and the system that had existed almost without challenge, literally for centuries. Actually, the way Mossadegh came to become prime minister is a fascinating story. Iran was a parliamentary democracy at that time, meaning that the parliament, elected by the people, would choose the prime minister from among its own members. At this time, the system was that the Shah, who was, according to the Constitution, supposed to rule as a constitutional monarch, like the Queen of England, would nominate a candidate for prime minister, and the Majlis, the Iranian parliament, would debate and decide whether this member of parliament was the right person to become prime minister. Well, the Shah, in 1951, had appointed one loyal, faithful member of parliament to become prime minister, and the parliament had to debate his nomination. Everyone expected that the first speaker would be Mossadegh, and that he would stand up and condemn this nominee as another lackey of the British, and another turncoat, another traitor to Iran, who didn't want democracy or freedom or self-determination. But Mossadegh didn't stand up. When the debate began, he remained seated, made no effort to make a talk. Another member of parliament stood up. I discovered during my research that he happened to have been on the payroll of the British intelligence service at this time. And this is what he said in his speech. He didn't speak about the nominee for prime minister at all. He spoke about the one person who was the most dominant, most forceful figure in all of Iranian politics. That was Mossadegh. And he pointed to him and said, "You are just one of those windbags who always protests, always criticizes from the outside, and never wants to take any responsibility. You are the example of what is wrong with our country and every developing country. All you want to do is criticize when people like the British are actually producing money, enterprises, and starting the kinds of businesses that make countries productive. You are the example of everything that is wrong with Iran. If you would become prime minister, you would see how difficult it is to deal with the whole world and all of Iran's problems. But you don't want to do that. You only want to criticize, as you have been doing ever since you were elected." This deputy then sat down, and another period of silence fell over the Majlis. Mossadegh then rose slowly from his chair. He took the microphone and said, "Thank you so much for the confidence you have expressed in me by nominating me for prime minister, and I accept." The entire parliament went into pandemonium. Within 1 hour, Mossadegh had been elected prime minister of Iran. Sensing the power that he had at that moment, he came back to the microphone and said, "I've decided there's one condition to my accepting the post. Before I accept, I want the Majlis to approve this bill I have proposed, mandating the nationalization of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. That bill was passed immediately. And the next day, Mossadegh became prime minister with the unanimous vote of parliament in favor of his resolution to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. Now, the process by which he hoped to nationalize it was very interesting. He went to the British and told them, we're nationalizing your oil company, and we're going to do it according to British law. At this moment, remember, Britain was nationalizing its own strategic industries. They nationalized the coal industry, the steel industry, the transport industry. And the law by which these nationalizations were carried out was very complicated. It allowed both parties, the nationalizer and the one being nationalized, to present their claims for how much money they had spent and how much money they believed they were owed. And it provided for a process by which these claims would be weighed, and it would be decided who owed who money and how much it would be. So Mossadegh really very cleverly embraced what was at that time British law. He didn't realize that, in the words of one British official who I quote in my book, socialism is all right back home, but out here you have to have a strong hand. Now, how did the British react to this profound, really earth-shattering challenge to their hegemony in Iran? First, they reacted with disbelief. This had never happened before, and the British could not believe that some elderly lunatic, that was Churchill's description of Mossadegh, in a bizarre faraway country, which is the way the British government perceived Iran, would have the temerity to stand up and propose such a preposterous suggestion. They thought that Mossadegh was just blackmailing them and he wanted to get a few extra million, just like corrupt leaders in the past had done. But it soon became clear to the British that Mossadegh was in deadly earnest, and that the enormous majority of the Iranian people supported him. There had never, in the modern history of Iran, been any political program that had been so fervently and passionately supported by the Iranian people as the nationalization of the oil company. So soon the British understood that this was a very serious challenge. So how did they respond? Very simple, according to their long experience in the world, they decided, we will invade Iran and take back the oil fields. They actually produced two different invasion plans. One was to take over all of Iran, and the other was to take over just the oil fields and their refinery. The British had built the world's largest refinery at Abadan in the Persian Gulf. Well, as the plans were underway, President Truman found out what was happening. He went crazy when he heard this, and he told the British in no uncertain terms, this is out of the question. We cannot possibly tolerate the idea here in the modern age of 1950s that Britain will send troops to invade a third world country. This is out of the question. We cannot support it. So this shocked the British. They decided on Plan B. And that plan was they would go to the United Nations, which was then an institution completely responsive to the big powers, and file a resolution, which they would submit for the endorsement of the Security Council, ordering Mossadegh to return the oil company to its British owners. Now, the Americans in the Truman administration tried in a friendly way to warn the British that maybe this wasn't such a good idea. That maybe when the world heard the British case and the Iranian case, they might not be all sympathetic with the British. But the British, caught up in the colonial mentality that had guided them for so long, brushed aside these protests. They I think, honestly believe that once the world saw how benevolent and how helpful and how friendly the British had been in Iran, they would naturally embrace the British cause and brush aside the foolish, maniacal desire of this elderly lunatic to nationalize the oil company. Well, things happened just the way the Americans had predicted. When Mossadegh found out that this resolution had been filed at the United Nations and that the British were going to try to use this mechanism to take back their oil company, not only was he not displeased, but he decided that he would personally fly to New York to present the Iranian case. He did this, and he made a tremendous impression in New York. He delivered extremely eloquent speeches at the Security Council, some of which I quote at some length in my book. After his presentation, the Security Council was so impressed that it rejected, really for the first time in the history of the UN, a proposal from one of the big powers. And of course, in classic diplomatic fashion, you know, the UN never decides anything yes or no. They did not disapprove the British resolution, but they approved a resolution that called for the postponement of this question until a certain date or indefinitely. Wonderful diplomatic phrase. Okay, that plan didn't work either. Now the British are going on to plan C. You can't invade. The UN will not help you. Fine. We'll arrange a coup. We'll overthrow Mossadegh, and we'll put someone in who will be friendly and will give us back our oil company. The problem was that Iran in those days, very much like Iran today, actually, for a country of many millions, is actually a very small town. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing. And when British agents started contacting Iranian officers and Iranian politicians to help them in their coup, Mossadegh immediately got news of this. He did the only thing that he could have done to protect himself. He closed the British embassy. He sent all the British diplomats home, and among them were all the secret agents who were going to plan the coup. So now the British were really in a fix. They had lost their oil company, which was really the foundation of their entire economic prosperity. They could not invade. The United Nations had not supported them, and now they couldn't even overthrow the guy who was tormenting them. They were stymied, and they were tremendously frustrated. In November of 1952, a huge surge of excitement charged through the British Foreign Office and the Secret Service with the news from America that a new administration had been elected in the United States. It was the election of Eisenhower, the change of government in the United States that electrified the British and made them think, maybe we can get this done after all. They had appealed to President Truman to organize a coup for them, but President Truman had refused. He told them, the CIA has never overthrown a government. This is not what the CIA is about. This is not what the CIA is for. The United States doesn't want to go off in this direction. We don't want to set this precedent. But the Eisenhower administration and the officials who were about to take office, particularly John Foster Dulles, who would be the incoming Secretary of State, and his brother Allen, who was the incoming CIA director, had a very different view of the world. Truman and Eisenhower really had the same assessment of the communist threat. They both took it extremely seriously. But where Truman and Eisenhower differed was how they decided to confront this threat. Truman's idea, as expressed by his brilliant Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, was that the United States should show the nationalists in Asia and Africa and Latin America that the United States was their true friend. His idea was that Americans should embrace the anti-colonialist nationalist ideology that was emerging throughout these parts of the world. That fell by the wayside when Eisenhower took office. Richard Nixon, who was Eisenhower's vice president, of course, had accused the previous administration of enrolling the United States